Good morning, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. Today, we are recording episode number 73, and I'm honored to have a returning guest to my to our podcast here. And everybody, you don't need introduction, Bruno and Paula, but Paula McGrath, the owner of International Achievers, and Bruno Herman, he's a well-known and renowned AI advocate and speaker. He's a strategic advisor to several companies out there. Welcome to the channel again, Paula and Bruno. Good to see you in good form this morning. Hopefully Friday is a good day for in Europe. I hear there's a lot of things on the sports side going on in Europe because you have the Europe Cup now and every excitement. I was on another call earlier and everybody was so excited about it, wearing the jersey. And I said, okay, I have to mention this morning. So welcome to the channel. For those who don't know you, if you don't mind, we'll start with Paula. Just give a brief introduction, and then we'll move to Bruno. Go ahead, Paula.
Hi, thanks, Robin. And thank you for having us as guests on your podcast. Just turned into a great success. Well done. I own and run International Achievers Group. We're a localization and translation recruitment agency. And that is the industry. We recruit globally. Our own staff are based globally. And we're, like everybody else, working hard to make sure we stay on top of the ever-changing needs of staff within this industry.
Absolutely. And welcome again, Paula. Good to have you with us. Bruno?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having us, Robin. It's always a pleasure. As you said, I'm back, so this is not my first time. But of course, today it's a very different topic than the one that we discussed before. So yes, my name is Bruno Herman. I'm based in Brussels in Belgium, in Europe, as you just said. I've been in the globalization and localization community for the past 30 years. I started in 1994. I started on the supplier side. And then a few years later, I moved to the client side, which is why I'm saying community and not industry. I'm still very much connected with suppliers, but of course, I'm more focused now on buyers, as they're called. So, and as you said, yeah, my current focus is definitely on AI or technology more broadly, and how humans can definitely still create value with technology and with AI in particular. So thanks.
Absolutely.
Again.
And thank you for having us with us, Bruno, this morning. Always good to see you both. One, I would like to dive into the topic of the hour that is everybody on everybody's mind, I guess. We've talked several times and we always indicated on this channel that we are going through a transformative time. There is no doubt about it. We're going through a transformative time. People are either excited about this transformative time, people are lukewarm about it in some cases, and some people are terrified about it. So you have three categories of how you view things, which is typical in any major transformative initiative that any industry takes on. AI, obviously, it's on the mind of people. AI is sort of like the elephant in the room in a lot of conversation. And in those conversations, again, are drawing to attention, what are we going to do and how are we going to deploy AI? What is the impact of AI deployment, etc.? One of the things that people on their mind, beside the technology aspect, beside all the other benefits that probably technology can bring, is the human aspect. So when we deploy AI, there are certain human impact that takes place. And would you mind, Bruno, we'll start with you, if you don't mind, run us through the human impact that AI may cause or may put in place.
Sure. And just for the whole clarity of this conversation, I'm going to talk about generative AI, because there are other types of AI like predictive AI, etc. So talking about generative AI, you're absolutely right, Robin. The impact on humans is significant, whether they like it or not, by the way. So it's not really a matter of preference. It's there. And it's there to stay. There is no indication that AI is going to disappear in 1 or 2 years from now. And when you look, when I put AI in perspective of the last, let's say, 30 years, this is one more, a big one, but one more change in terms of technology that is impacting humans. It happened before and it will happen again in the future. So it's important probably for all of us to keep that in mind and to put a generative AI in perspective of other things like the time and, of course, how humans are going to be combined with AI. And that's, you know, that's key. We're going to probably talk a lot about that and the impact on jobs, etc., a bit later on. But I would say that, as you said, it's the elephant in the room in many cases. You know, as usual, I would say, when there is an elephant like that in the room, some people want to move it very fast and some people don't want to move it at all. So that's the reaction. It's human nature, I believe. When you have people who want to really, you know, they are so excited that they really want to use AI, they want to play with AI, they want to experiment AI. And you have other people who are much more reluctant, probably scared in many cases. And actually, these people are just looking at it. They are, you know, trying to find a way to avoid it sometimes, which is, in my opinion, quite difficult, but okay. So if we look at the impact on the language industry, which we're talking about today, I would say that the impact on project management, project managers, I should say, linguists, technologists, all these roles that are, you know, so important in the language industry are already impacted. And I would say that the impact is not just AI as a feature, as a tech feature, because, of course, you know, it changes a lot in terms of workflows, in terms of, in terms of how projects are managed. And I keep it like this for the moment. We are going to dive into that a bit later. But it's not just AI as a tech feature. It's also what AI as a tech feature is doing on the client side. And that, of course, has an impact on the supplier side. Because when you look at all these organizations, for the moment, mostly big organizations, large organizations, multinationals, but not just that. I mean, also some startups, some scale-ups, they invest a lot in AI. So the return on investment that they expect from this investment, which is quite significant, is going to be, of course, on savings. Not just savings, but there will be a number of other benefits. You know, when we say savings, that implies less work for suppliers because AI and generative AI can really enable a number of client organizations to internalize much more than what they've been doing so far. In other words, the AI, generative AI can enable them to do more in-house and, you know, as a result of that, do less with outsourced projects. It's connected vessels. You know, the more you do internally, the less you do externally. That is the challenge that is really beyond, I would say, the direct impact of AI on jobs in the language industry. It is the indirect challenge for the language industry, which is mostly coming from the client side. But I'm really glad because for me, this is a huge opportunity for suppliers. I'm really glad that a number of companies, language services suppliers, have already started transforming their, you know, roles, their workflows, and their tech to keep working or to keep creating value for clients. So a direct impact plus an indirect impact. I think that's the whole picture that I would like for people to consider.
Absolutely. You know, there are a couple of points that you bring up that I'd like to dig into a little later, specifically on creating value. Paula, what's your take on the human impact from AI?
I should have mentioned earlier is that Bruno works as a strategic advisor with our company. We're very lucky to have him on board. A number of these conversations are being had between myself and Bruno for the last 10 months. What I'm seeing in our agency is, funnily enough, I look at the most common job title that's still being requested. It's still the most common job title is still project manager. Now, everybody knows that the project manager title can cover a massive range of duties and responsibilities. What I'm seeing is that the duties and responsibilities on the supplier side, we work with both, but most of our business truthfully comes from the supplier side. So the requirements within the job spec are starting to change slightly, but the titles Now, again, I'm giving a very general discussion here, topic here. It's not that all our jobs are project managers, but the most common job still coming through is titled project manager.
Okay. But
the definition or the requirements within it is starting to change slightly. That's on the supplier side.
So are you seeing a shift in the skill requirement, Paula?
Yes, starting to very slowly. And it's one or two little changes. It's not massive change. Mm-hmm. It's just one or two little change. Individual ideally has experience, 1 year's experience in X. So it is starting to change, but little by little. I mean, we are. That's what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Job titles are not necessarily changing yet.
Yeah, but overall, most our audience would know that we work in an industry that is absolutely resistant to change.
Yeah.
When, you know, you're faced with massive change like this, you know, it's very common to see, you know, these slow changes taking place. It's called creep change, right? So you just change a little bit at a time, a little bit at a time. You don't want to shock the system. You know, years ago, I was, you know, big proponent of changing the titles of project management. You know, call them customer service, whatever you want to call them. But the project management itself, and that's a completely different discussion for another day, it has a different really outline of what our project manager in the language industry does and their daily tasks are. So when you go take a professional project management degree, you achieve other things than just pushing files around in a language company.
I've got a postgrad diploma in project management, so I know I did all that. But it doesn't look like most old lady. What would I know?
I would like to talk a little bit about, from your perspective, while you got the mic there, Paula, like, are you noticing a trend, or is there a trend, I would call it a trend or whatever we want to call it, in terms of, we talked a little bit about, you know, when AI comes in to an organization in terms of an initiative or in terms of brand new technology that we're going to take on or developing something. Are you seeing, you know, the chicken and the egg scenario? Are you seeing like technology comes in and then we scramble to train people? Are we training people? Are we upskilling people? Are we hiring brand new people? What is it? Do you have any of those scenarios going on? Or?
Yeah, but I've always had, yes, we do have those scenarios in some clients and we don't have it with other clients. So what I see is that it varies from culture to culture within an organization. So some organizations have always had or are lucky to have a period of time where their CEO or their head of operations is naturally innovative and brave and knows how to maximize the use of all the resources. And they're comfortable in moving more quickly with the change. But there's always organizations who don't. And some of them survive despite that. Some of them thrive despite that, because, you know, if they have, you know, maybe if they have clients that are in the public sector space or the government space. So, you know, the government doesn't always change as quickly as private industry. So if any of our supplier clients are working with government clients around the world, they don't seem to need to be in as much a rush as as suppliers who are predominantly, you know, servicing other private organizations or even publicly quoted organizations who are obliged for their shareholders to make change. Sorry, that's a very long-winded answer that really translates into it is varying from culture to culture, as it always has. I've always seen that. So I've been in recruitment an awful long time across multiple industries in my earlier days. And what's happening now to me mirrors what I saw happening 10 years ago, when I saw happening post Lehman Brothers, when I saw, you know, that's what I'm seeing. It really does depend from culture to culture.
You know, one of the good things that I'm hearing through your answer there, Paula, is people are still looking for hire people. And I would I was under the impression, well, I was scared actually, like everybody else, that, you know, our industry will stop hiring people. And we start really looking at regression instead of increasing the business. And we sort of talked about this in our pre-call yesterday a little bit. And I don't, you know, every indicator out there, you hear, you know, business is increasing, that mean you have to hire more people. But if you talk about it from the buyer side doesn't see that. And there is a phenomenon taking place. I'm not sure you guys are seeing that in Europe. is called, and I think I coined that that phrase, is democratizing translation. So used to be, for instance, you know, translation used to go to a central place, a central location, and from there it finds its way to the supplier. Now what we're seeing is the user, the business decision maker, the user is making those decisions because they've got the tools now. Even if their IT, like it's very interesting, even if their IT teams block these, you know, premature technologies from entering into their network, you know, they're finding ways to get on it. Like they're downloading it on their app, they're putting on their iPhone, and they have ChatGPT now on their phone and they're working with it. I'm not supposed to be using it. I'm using it anyway because it's instantaneous, it's convenient, and I can use it. So this is now, we either get on board with democratizing translation to the end user, and then either we're transforming our businesses from large businesses catering to large companies, which you'll always have that, but you got to figure out to get a little bit more flexible and innovative in providing value for the individual user. And that's where Bruno was had an interesting theory yesterday, or an interesting conversation. You always talked about that, Bruno, in the past, is creating the value. You have to create value in the new environment. Can you comment on this one, Bruno?
Sure. Well, that's a key point, Robin. And I think that you're absolutely right about democratizing translation. What I see more and more, and this is not really new, but the trend is increasing as far as I can see it. What I see more and more is that a number of organizations, not all of them, let me be clear, so it's not going to be the whole set of clients around the world, but a number of organizations, again, regardless of size, and sometimes even regardless of industry, these client organizations are keen, if they know how to do it, they are keen to elevate and integrate language services in their content supply chain or their product supply chain. Because I think that today, on the buyer side, I'm going to oversimplify it for, you know, for our conversation, but I see two groups of buyers. There are buyers who are still considering translation, localization, what's it, language services as pure commodity. And, you know, they use suppliers, they buy files, they buy, you know, some work per word, etc. So the traditional, what I've seen for the past 30 years when I was on the buyer and the supplier side. So I could see that the interaction, which was very transactional, very much based on, I'm the client, I'm going to use my suppliers because I need them. Because, you know, they can do something I cannot do. And you know, to be honest, when I was talking to some peers in the community, those in those companies using language services as commodity, usually localization people were frustrated because they said that they were only called when needed. They were not recognized by their senior leadership because the senior leadership didn't see language services as a profit driver. You know, the situation within those buyers considering commodity only was not great for suppliers and also for internal teams dealing with, you know, language services. And then there is another group of buyers that was years ago that was a little bit innovative or a little bit sometimes controversial, which was to, well, these buyers said that, and I was lucky to work with four, I was an employee at that time, for two of them. That these organizations were saying, no, language management, language services is creating value or has to create value. And if that's the case, or since this is the case, there is no point in considering language services as a commodity. There is a point in considering, language services as a profit driver. And as a result of that, it needs to be more, as I said before, elevate it first and then integrate it in our, you know, corporate supply chains, content and or product. Because every company has a supply chain, right? You know, whatever you do, if you are producing cars, you have a supply chain, which is very physical. If you are a Netflix, you also have a supply chain because you produce content and you are different roles in this supply chain. And I think that's where, you know, the value comes to play. Because in the first group, the value of language services is, I wouldn't say ignored, but it's definitely underestimated. And this is because of commodity. Well, when I go to the grocery, when I buy some meat, yeah, what does this meat create as value for me? Maybe just to keep me busy for my dinner. That's it. But, you know, when you consider, when you move from this commodity-based approach to some, you know, a supply chain-based approach, you are not just elevating and integrating language services and language management in the supply chain, which means that if you have an internal team, this team will be also more connected with the other people in the supply chain, the designers, the developers, the testers, the UX people. Well, you have a number of people already in the supply chain. And of course, being integrated as a localization leader, being integrated in this supply chain is added value, because then I'm going to be more recognized as a leader. And that's where, of course, the value comes more clearly, comes up more clearly, because, you know, of course, if language management is not part of the supply chain, there is something broken, mm-hmm. because you cannot just sell internationally. You realize that, you know, okay, your content, your product is designed, developed, tested, and then suddenly there is a gap, there is a hole, and then, you know, nothing happens. And then you want to sell it in France or in Brazil or in China, and you cannot do it just because it's in English only. So that is really where the value comes to play. And going back to our transformation discussion, what is really important to me, because I do want suppliers in the language industry to keep creating value. I always have a very positive message, and I know some suppliers see me as an enemy, but I'm not an enemy.
Why?
I'm just trying to help them, which is to say, yes, look at how your client is considering localization or language services. Don't try to, you know, project your own view, your own vision to the client side. Just, you know, investigate and really grasp what the view, what the vision, what the consideration of language services is on your client side. And then, you know, since we talk about AI, you have a client today that is implementing, you know, generative AI because it's part of the corporate plan. Many companies are doing it now. You realize that, of course, this client of yours is going to look for some return on investment to offset the huge investment in generative AI. And of course, you know, you might at that point in time, you might say, oh, me as a supplier, I need to change my role, my overall value, because of course this client is implementing generative AI and is going to be enabled to, you know, start creating content in multiple languages or use AI for translation localization. And of course, you know, at that point in time, you need to find, as a supplier, you need to find a way to keep creating value. And I'm going to just mention one way of doing it, just one, because I know it's a major one, which is that in today, a number of organizations are in the process of creating data for AI, because AI has to work with data. You know, AI doesn't work with files. Just forget your PDF, forget your MP4, etc. And this sort of requirement sounds very simple. Yeah, you need data for AI to train and maintain your AI, your generative AI engine. Well, it's not that simple, simply because some organizations have already a very robust data strategy, but of course, in a number of cases, they won't have so much attention already now, not yet, about, you know, language data, which is to specifically train AI in multiple languages. But of course, a number of other organizations don't have such an impressive data strategy, but they have millions of files, Robin. They have millions of customer service files, but they have millions of product sheets. They have millions of communication press releases, etc. But of course, all these files are in multiple formats, in multiple languages, which is great, but multiple formats, it's not that great because you need to convert that. And actually, what do you need as an expertise to create value from these files
to convert them
to actually go to the data for AI? You need two types of expertise: data science and language expertise. You bring them together, you have a boulevard in front of you.
That's right. And thanks for clarifying this, because a lot of people on their mind right now is, okay, so what do I do? And if we're addressing, and through this podcast, if we're addressing like the entire localization industry on the buyer and on the supplier side, you know, these are things that people are worried about, like, what do I do, what kind of services I can create, etc. And people are, you know, for, I don't know what it is, I think there'd be a lot of benefit for people talking to each other, right? So listening to this podcast, for instance, listening to you, talking to you, reaching out to other experts if they have preferred other experts, mm-hmm. and talk to them, consult with them, understand what's possible. What tend to happen is, and I've seen it many times over, is people have a blinders on and they mm-hmm. sit in their own ecosystem. And for the pride or for whatever it is, they think they know everything, but they mm-hmm. evidently we don't, and nobody does. And if somebody claims they know everything, then I don't know what planet they're on.
Yeah.
They're asleep.
My point is, we need to share information, seek help privately or in public, you know, reach out to an advisor such as Bruno and Paula and check with them, say, oh, what's possible? How can we make this work? What do we need to do? How do I, and in a lot of cases, you're on a, you know, a strategic advisor such as Bruno and Paula, you're probably on a rescue mission in a lot of cases, because these companies are coming into the edge of the cliff and you guys are coming in saying, hey, hang on a second, let me get you back to where you're supposed to be. And let me rescue you a little bit, inject a few ideas, brand new ideas, and upskill their employees to where they need to be. And go back to upskilling. I'd like to address this a little bit. So if I was a project manager, for instance, and you talked about data scientists and a language specialist working together on datafication of the content, Bruno,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know how many translation companies out there out of the 19,000 have a data scientist on staff. I'll bet you the percentage is very tiny because yep. they most likely have linguists on staff and language specialists, but data scientists, mm-hmm. nobody, you know, they don't, mm-hmm. I don't imagine it. Many of them have them, those skills on staff. So how do we yep. take, you know, a new environment, a new tools, et cetera?
Tech change, but human change. And before answering your question or before going back to this point, I have to tell that I was lucky enough. I didn't know I was lucky at that time, but now I can say I was lucky enough to work for 15 years for a data science company, a world leader in business intelligence. And in my team, there were local. I was responsible. I was leading globalization, the globalization strategy. And in my team, I was lucky. And again, now I know I was, but at that time, I was not so sure. I was lucky to have people. Traditional roles in terms of language management, like project managers, linguists, DTP specialists, etc. The more or less the second half of my team was made of data scientists. And in the beginning, when I was sort of building my team, I wasn't so sure that those two groups of people could work together because they're quite different, right, in terms of profiles. On one side, you have language expertise, and on the other side, you have data management expertise. But after, more than 10 years in my role as the globalization leader, I could say and I could tell that, you know, it was working. It was working because these two groups realized that, and of course, at that time, I was already involved in language data because in BI, you know, it's just one letter of difference, but BI was already based on data. And of course, you had all these labels that were language data, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I remember that. In the beginning, of course, it was not so natural to make those two groups work together. But what I could see is that after a while might be, of course, a matter of months, not just, you know, overnight, those two groups realized that each had a real value, a real expertise to bring and to combine with the other one. So language expertise is great, but, a data passionate linguist is not a data scientist. And on the other side, you have data scientists that have, they all have this passion and this expertise in, you know, data lifecycle management, you know, acquisition, curation, annotation, etc. But of course, a multilingual data scientist doesn't make, you know, a linguist. Having come to the conclusion that those two expertise were just needed, and it works. It can work, but of course, it's a matter of leadership and it's a matter of executive sponsorship as well. Now, going back...
Go ahead, finish your thought.
No. So just going back to your initial point and your initial question to me, I think that for suppliers, they don't have to actually to, of course, my advice is to have at least a few people who are experts in data management. All right. So that they have, in addition to the linguist, in addition to the project managers, they also have, in-house data scientists. But let's assume that, we are talking to a small LSP, and that LSP is going to say, sorry, I cannot invest in recruiting, a bunch of data scientists. I would say that my message to that small LSP would still be positive, because I would say hire project managers and hire linguists who are really deep into the language expertise. And you don't need to hire specifically data scientists, but you work with organizations that have a data scientist group or data science team. And then you go to the client and in the pitch, in the bid defense call, you say that obviously you might not have, of course, the data science capacity and capability, but your client already has that. And you say that you bring something else, something new that the client doesn't have, yep, which is language expertise. And you say that your project managers are, versed in data management. They know what how data works. No, you can tell the client that, your linguists are used to language data, and they know what format it is, and they know how language data creates value, etc. So you keep your expertise in terms of language management with transformed roles, sometimes not new titles, as Paula just said, but then you go and you actually position yourself, you create your value proposition on something different, which is not to transaction files. Don't send me files anymore that I can translate in 25 languages. Make sure that, I can work with your data science team, and together we're going to convert all your content assets into data for AI. And so me, as a small LSP, I'm going to keep creating value for you in a totally different way than, when it was about transactioning files.
Oh, absolutely. And, those are very good points in terms of how that whole datafication and training, it's important right now. And this is where the world is going. And over the past year, I mean, this industry has created trillions of data points for any company. Like, we've been translating for like 20, 30 years in a lot of these companies. And they have tons of data, potential data. Currently, it's sitting in files, but potential data down the road. For the audience, data does not equal your Word document file that is sitting on your desk. That's not what Bruno is alluding to. Mm-hmm. Bruno is alluding to your data being those files segmented into data fields that can be transacted over SQL or any other database format that you're probably going to be using. Data is like Bruno was mentioning that he worked in data before, but many of our audience don't know that I was a DBA in my early career before, database administrator before, and I worked initially on IBM platforms in a DB2 environment, and I was the first one in the company, in a big insurance company that I worked for, that I adopted the SQL and the JCL job control language to manage all these data formats inside of a large data repositories. Very interesting topic to be talking about, moving from the language assets that you currently have to data, which now we have action data. And if you want to think about it for our audience, you have, let's say, 1 terabyte of files sitting in your information system somewhere. What is it doing? Nothing. Zero. It's sitting there, exactly. Static. It's doing nothing. How about if you take those repository of databases or files and you convert them into databases in a variety of ways? You can structure that. You can hire, as Bruno was mentioning, you can hire somebody from the outside to help you out and take these files and structure them into data fields, recognizable data fields, searchable. I can get to a topic. I can search quickly in a database, a query a database, and figure out what's going on in the database. Now, from a database to a database, I can transact it pretty easy. I can exchange data now. I can send it to a customer, receive it from a customer. It's very much easier than sending a file to a project manager, and the project manager has to go through the litany of checks and balances before we send that file to be translated. Very new world you're describing there, Bruno.
Yeah, very new. And I would say very, in my mind, very promising, very positive.
Well, that's the bright future that we talk about all the time, right?
But I think that, to be honest, that's what I see with the organizations I'm working with now. And I will give you an example, because I'm one day per week, I'm working with an e-commerce site. They are based in Asia, but they have, you know, five languages in Europe, the major markets as usual. And, you know, when I started working with them, or even before working with them, I was asking, you know, if they had some data strategy. And of course they said, yeah, we have a BI strategy. And they said, no, I mean, I'm talking about language data or data for AI that could be used for generative AI, not BI specifically. And they were saying, we have nothing. And to your point, that was completely wrong, because they had a lot. They had, you know, customer service conversations recorded. Of course, you know, this had to be transcribed, of course, into text first, and then for the rest of the data lifecycle. They had a number of, you know, product sheets that for products they were selling in different formats, most of all for Word and a few in PowerPoints. And I said, you are sitting on the gold mine, but now it's time to sort of not just sit on the gold mine, but to go in the mine and you know take the gold that is in the mine.
Well, because most people agree today that the currency, the hard currency that even people are trading right now, it's not dollars, it's not Bitcoin, it's data.
It's data, And you know, when I'm working with Paola and her team, about, you know, the client needs and you know, the people who are indeed engaging international achievers, because they need resources, they need project managers, they need, engineers, linguists, all the roles that are in the language industry. I say, well, you know what? Keep in mind that, you know, you are going to hire not just for today, but also for tomorrow.
True.
And obviously that makes a difference in the profile. And not just in the job description, because a job description, we all know. I'm going to let Paola describe go deeper into the job descriptions. In my own experience, a job description is just a small overview of what you are going to do, essentially, in the real life.
Yep.
You know, it's not just a matter of, you know, adapting the job description for the candidates, but it's also a matter of selecting the candidates in a different way, with a business case, ideally. And even if there is no business case, just in the interviews, make sure that they have this mindset, because I'm going to quote a professor of international business at Harvard, and she said that AI is implying new tool sets, new skill sets, and new mindsets. And I think new mindsets is really relevant. Selecting people during interviews, as I said, before or after a business case, doesn't matter, you know, is going to be really critical to make sure that they have the mindset, of course, to work today, but also to go through all the changes that are going to be, you know, in store for the next months, years. But Paola, you have stories about that.
Go ahead, Paola.
I'm not going to step on your toes.
Funny enough, I was actually trying to think about, so what will dictate success for one organization and not success for another organization, you know, recruiting now? And I think it actually largely happens two or three steps before the recruiting even starts. I think it starts at the point where an organization has the time, makes the time, has the resources, makes the resources to actually do an analysis and an audit of what we have, what we need, and have their 12-month, 24-month, and 36-month needs in mind. And I think if that's not done, I think when that's done and done effectively, that's funny enough, something Bruno's very good at, when that is done effectively, the difference it makes, the recruiting is just literally doing what one needs to do. You have to act legally, morally, and effectively, the usual things, you know, but identifying what's needed properly is what I think dictates the difference, improves the chance of success so much more.
Absolutely.
I don't know if I've oversimplified it, but that's my experience.
You bring a very good point, Paula, like hiring people, buying systems, renting space, all after the fact. Because, you know, the initial thing, it was the strategy, you know, put a strategy together of where you want to go, how do you want to get there, and put a plan. Most people right now, and that's why we're having this conversation, which is very intriguing. Some people have the luxury of, you know, taking a step back and putting a strategy together and putting a plan together. To be honest, and let's be frank with each other, I mean, many of our companies in our industries today, they're barely hanging on. I mean, I don't know, you know, the statistics on the analysis that we see out there that talks about the prosperity and, you know, growth of industry. But there are many companies are hanging on. I mean, I had a few people coming on the podcast, you know, they're telling me that, you know, the biggest activity taking place right now, well, one of the biggest activity taking place in place right now is on the broker side. You know, these are people who are brokering either the sale or the buy of a company. And it's just tells you, it's an indicator that tells you that either people are afraid. You know, some people are saying, I've had too many changes in this industry. I give up. I'm just going to pass this company on to somebody else. Some people are closing their companies. I mean, that's the reality, right? Yeah. So, I mean, we'd love to see a, you know, glass half full, and we're all for that. It's sometimes we have to talk in real term with each other and be honest with each other.
That's a great point. Yeah.
I'm sorry, Bruno.
No, it's just
I also think a collaboration of skills would make such a difference with some of these. So if I don't own an LSP, I own a recruiting agency, but the same applies. Some of what we do is not dissimilar to what the LSPs do, to be honest with you, but we provide staff for organizations, and sometimes that's what an awful lot of LSPs are doing too, with specialist skills. A collaboration of skills. So, you know, when things are starting to move a different way, and you know you don't have the time, the affordability, and you're the leader in an organization to retrain yourself, but you're looking at Mr. So-and-so over there who has that. He has an agency maybe the same size. The collaboration of skills could really make a massive difference to the survival of both organizations. Now, I know it can be quite difficult to merge. I don't want to make it sound like you can wake up tomorrow and suddenly you've got this magical, you know, highly performing organization. However, I do think collaboration of skills, and I'm talking from a commercial perspective. I'm not necessarily, I'm not talking about from a completely altruistic perspective. I don't know that that's looked at in time. You know, it's in time for people to actually wake up and go, oh my goodness. I can also see online and sometimes with organizations that have worked with us in the past, but are not able to work with us at the moment. And I can see they're starting to change their offering and their, in, you know, changing their revenue streams, and you know, I can see people are training others in AI, but at least they're doing something. You know, they're actually finding a market, staying within the industry, possibly until they get the chance to get to where they need to be with their own internal resources to go back to what they were predominantly doing. You know, stuff like that I can see happening, but I do think people need to be big and brave and say, "Listen, can we have a talk?" And you may have to have 10 talks to come up with one prince. Can we have a talk? We just can. How about you and I talk about keeping our businesses going here?
Absolutely. This industry,
and I'm good at that.
This industry work the same in every company. It's the same work being done by every company. Not much different. We're not putting rockets on the moon here, and they're very similar in every aspect. Yeah. But you know, with little nuances of differences, which doesn't really, you know, warrant a huge discussion on this company is different than the other company. It's pretty much they're all the same. But meanwhile, if you take a scan across, and I don't know, maybe that's just my feeling. I don't know. People are so enclosed into their, it's like they have their grandmother's secret recipe for a good Italian sauce, and they refuse to give that away. You know, they refuse to think that, look, I mean, what you're doing, 15,000 other companies are doing exactly the same thing.
I know, but if you think of the personality that's needed, Robin, for somebody to get up every day and battle your way through the business owner's day, because most of us business owners, truthfully, could earn an awful lot more money for most of our business life having high-end jobs. We can, but it's not how we're built. So that's the flip side. That's the downside of the personality that gets up every day and battles through. It can be very it's very difficult, that identity. What
I'm talking about here is the blue ocean, red ocean. The industry currently is working in a red ocean, and it looks very red, and it's completely red. And what we're talking about is that innovation, that creating value, that bringing on in new services. This is the blue ocean that we're trying to create to move away from, you know, the commoditization of the services, the beating each other on a price per word kind of a conversation, move away from that to other things, to more prosperous things, to brand new innovative services that not many people are offering them, to be honest with you. And I don't know if we down the road qualify these companies LSP anymore. They should be like language data companies more than an LSP, if I would say.
Well, you can use, Robin, if you really want to be generic, you may want to use language business partner, because that, then, of course, you have in language, it covers everything, technology, everything. So as, and of course, it gives this flavor of a business partner, which is not just a vendor.
True.
So,
yeah. True.
I agree with you, by the way.
Go ahead, Paula.
I also, can I just, because, you know, Bruno and I also have a podcast. We're at the very, very early stages of this. And the main driver for that was to try and find a way to talk with buyers, organizations who are using suppliers, and to try and give some guidance to the suppliers on how to improve the way to get in to win business. And we interviewed this lady about 3 weeks ago, and she's in a very senior position in one of the big branded names. And she actually said, I don't want suppliers coming in telling me we can do this, that, and the other, when I actually know they should know. I have much cheaper ways of doing that now. And yep. I actually think there's a fair amount of underestimate. There's an awful lot of that going on. So, you know, she said sometimes, you know, people come in and they're underestimating the fact I have five people behind there who are doing that for a third of the price that you guys are trying to sell to me. So it's back to what something that Bruno keeps hammering home is that make sure my team listen, tell the LSPs to listen.
Yeah.
And don't, you know, for me, I'm extrapolating on that to say, don't underestimate what's already going on.
That's right. Yeah. And there is a simple tip that I would also give to LSPs or language business partners today is actually that it's probably more important than before to start also recruiting people from the client side to work in your company as a supplier.
Oh,
don't try to chase, because of course, you know, I know how suppliers are recruiting and they try to chase, you know, PMs or engineers from their competitors. And so
that's
you
right.
have, of course, some people moving from one LSP to the other one and then to the other one, but it remains, I'm going to use a strong word, but it remains quite incestuous.
True.
And actually, if you are recruiting people who have experience working in a client organization, not just for a client organization, you actually bring somebody who has been in the trenches, and who has been really dealing with all the challenges on the client
sure.
side, which are politics, dynamics, supply chains, etc. Because a PM on the supplier side, and I know I had several discussions about that with a couple of important people in the industry. They keep saying that, you know, people who have been working, who are still working for clients, they know clients. Yes, they know what the clients want to tell them, which is the difference than what the clients actually does. And I know that because I could never say everything to my suppliers. It's part of the game, if I can put it like that. So don't believe that the people who know best your clients are the people who work for your clients.
Yep.
These are the people who work in your clients.
Correct.
And bring them to your organization, and you will be able to create even more value and you know, stay relevant.
So basically promoting hiring non-traditional expertise instead of that project manager that keeps going around from one company to another. Bring somebody from the outside.
Yeah.
We need that.
Yeah. Well, right now I'm working with a couple of organizations in the advertising agency world. So in the advertising industry.
True.
And they do that on a regular basis. You know, they recruit people coming from their clients, because they see that these people are going to be great to work on the supplier, on the agency side. And there is a real exchange or a real, interaction between the supplier and the buyer side in the advertising agency. In other words, of course, you know, the big advertising agencies, they want to recruit, you know, like Publicis wants to recruit people from Havas or vice versa.
Yeah.
But they bring also people from their clients who these people want to have something else. They want to work more on the supplier sure. side, which is absolutely respectable. But there is no insistence recruitment approach, which I would definitely not recommend at this point in time, considering that a number of bio organizations are also internalizing more, yep. specifically in life science and finance. So don't be too sure about the future. You know, take control of your future and, you know, make it happen and stay relevant.
Yeah, that's right. Stay relevant. That's a very interesting point. No. Sorry to we have to bring this call to a wrap here. I just want to make sure mm-hmm. that we summarize a little bit of our conversation to the audience. So if you can summarize for us what your recommendation would be, Bruno and Paula, in a few words, what you are recommending today and what your advice is today, that'd be great.
I'm going to go first, Bruno, if that's okay. For me, I mentioned about the importance of doing an analysis and an audit of what you currently have, what you need for your next 12, 24 and 36 months before you start either internally recruiting and training and or externally recruiting, because it makes such a massive difference and it doesn't feel so much like a fire sale.
Okay. Excellent.
That's the big thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And for me, just to sort of probably circle back on, I think my first comment is actually that the impact of AI on the language industry is going to be, for me, twofold, or is already twofold. Not going to be, but it's already twofold. The first one is the direct impact, as I said, which is to make sure that, you know, if you are a supplier, you can transform, you can adapt your roles, your processes and your technology to, you know, to the infusion mm-hmm. of AI as a feature, first of all, on your clients, within your clients, and also on yourself. And then there is the indirect impact, as I said, which is that there are so many buyers organizations, so many corporate organizations that are now investing, and it's a huge investment, investing in AI. And part of that is on generative mm-hmm. AI. And of course, make sure that you talk to these clients, and more often than not, they will tell you that, of course, there is a plan not just to invest in AI, but to have a return on investment. And that return on investment is called value.
Okay.
And if you are sort of plugged to this return on investment, you are going to be safe for probably the next couple of years. If you are not plugged to that, try to do something.
Yeah, you may be shaky, on a shaky ground. So I want to thank our panel today, both Bruno and Paula. Really appreciate having you with me this afternoon for you. And I want to make sure that from our audience, I hope you enjoyed this conversation. It's pretty interesting to be talking about some of the topics that we normally don't hear about those in a conference. And if they come up in a conference, they would be probably deemed, disruptors and, outside the box a little bit. And that's what this conversation and this channel is about, is to bring on these opinions and these conversations that sometimes not talked about enough and bring them out to the surface. So on behalf of the audience and on behalf of Bruno and Paula and myself, I want to thank everybody for listening in today. Thanks for watching us on YouTube. And if you haven't done so already, I appreciate your subscription or commenting or liking our content. This content is being put together on a weekly basis, and it's not my full-time job. I do other things. And so I want to make sure that I continue bring on these conversations to the industry and to the rest of the world. And Bruno, congratulations on your being our most watched and most listened to episode in podcast. I really appreciate that. Almost 5,000 views. Similarly on the podcast side of much.
Thank you.
And until next time, this is Robin Ayoub, Bruno Herman, and Paula McGrath signing off. Thank you.